Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave Krueger. I'm excited about our group, and especially thank you to those of you who have already responded to the couple of questions that I sent around, what you would most like to have addressed about this topic and what you would like to walk away with at the end of our seminar series. You'll notice, those of you who have been exposed to me before, these are the first couple of questions that you likely will ask your client. What you want us to focus on, where would you like us to get to? So we're going to develop the coaching wellness story just as you develop a coaching story with your client. There are a number of people. Thank you for managing the background noise. I'll reserve a bit of time at the beginning and the end for any questions, clarifications, things that you'd like to discuss a bit more, and then I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about it. So anything you want to add to anything you've sent in, or those of you who have not sent in, is there anything you'd like to add now about the most important question you have about our topic and what you'd like to walk away with?
What are the questions?
Go ahead. Say it again.
What are the questions, David? You know, I didn't get them.
Oh, I sent. If you may have registered recently, I sent them mid afternoon. Okay. Right now, what's the most important question you have about this topic? And after our four seminars, if you walk away saying this is one of the best seminars you've ever attended, what would you walk away with? So any immediate response. Let me begin by answering two or three of you who have raised similar kinds of questions. You do not need – could I get a management of the background noise while we're still on open mic here? If you're shuffling a paper or moving about, it'll pick it up. So do a mute button or star six. I'll put us on lecture mode in just a moment. So you do not need any healthcare background or any training to have anything to do with wellness other than your training as a professional coach. You're not a consultant. You're not a content expert. You're not going to be providing information. You're not a dietitian, a nutritionist. You're not a healthcare expert in any way, even a fitness person. So you're a coach, and this is simply focus of the coaching that you'll be doing. We'll develop that, and you'll see what can be applied to wellness in a system that I want to develop with you. And some of you have heard me say, probably repeatedly, if you want to help someone change, don't focus just on the outcome or the goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. Focus on the system. So we're going to develop a system to use in coaching that can be applied to wellness, but it can be applied to other aspects as well, but we're going to focus on wellness. So before we officially launch here, anything else you want to add or ask or just comment on?
Dave, you said focus on the system, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
And that's exactly what we do in coaching. The system is to develop a map with the client of what you focus on, where the client wants to get to with that focus, and then successively approximate that goal. That's the map, the two coordinates, where the client is in focus, where they want to get to. Then you can measure progress along the way, and you can tell what's deviation and distraction. So you collaboratively establish that with a client as point of reference to move to their goal for that conversation. So you've developed a coaching story each time you meet with a client for a conversation. We're just going to apply that to wellness and look at that system much more specifically as applied to wellness. So anything else to add or ask before I put us on lecture mode and officially start? If you have responses to those questions or want to add or ask anything, jot it down. We'll come back to it at the end. And you can always fire off an email, and we'll incorporate the responses that you've had, the questions, and hoped for goals of this in the discussion. It will inform some of the things that I discuss as we develop this. So I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise. Hold on. Okay, in our first session, we'll talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. Now, the outline and the workbook you have probably seen at the link that you were sent when you registered and the link that I resent, I'd suggest maybe printing the outline so you have something to jot down anything important. A suggestion: as you engage with each seminar, at some point, maybe toward the end, write down the most important thing that you're taking away from this seminar, each of the four seminars. There's something about writing it down that makes it even more memorable and retrievable. University of Waterloo did a study where a large group of matched participants, volunteers, read the same story, half read it out loud, half read it silently. They were then given the same test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They put it in an output channel. So I will speak to you about your wellness story. I encourage you to do the exercises and the work pages and the workbook that parallel our discussions here. There are four modules, four seminars, and the outline really follows the structure of both of those. And there are work pages, exercises, in the workbook that you may find beneficial to do, and you may even see if it might be helpful to use with certain clients. So although we'll discuss application to wellness, you're going to see, I think, that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and success. So let's ask that question that I saw repeatedly in a different way. Why you? Why you as a wellness coach? You're professionals who know how to listen and be a catalyst to guide people to co-create a new story. You're change experts and choice architects. You know that intentions need a strategy and a plan. We're going to talk about a proven system of change and transformation for lasting change. The roadmap, which we'll get into beginning next seminar, is an acronym for the 7 steps to create a new wellness story. It's a plan, a system to guide you to empowered wellness in your story, and then you can coach it. So let's begin broadly. What's the need for wellness coaching? You've seen what I believe are some compelling statistics in the workbook preface, if you've seen that. Here's my belief. People don't need more advice about vitamins or told again to exercise or lose weight or stop smoking. They usually don't do what they're told, even when they pay to be told. Here's a simple example of that. Of people who go to see a physician, they're maybe in pain, scared. They pay to consult an expert. Let's say the upshot of that expert advice is in the form of a prescription. Well, how does that work when they go to an expert and get expert advice? Slightly less than 50% actually fill the prescription. Of those who do fill it, just under 50% actually take it as directed. So less than 25% of people pay for the expert advice they give. And some of you have heard me say this in a totally different way, that information is not a way to change anyone's mind. Information, education, data, if they happen to have a tool called Google, they won't need that, and you'd be out of business. If information were enough, we would all eat mostly vegetables, be thin, work out every day, have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. So what we do is to collaboratively ally with a client to help them understand and create an evolving and transforming new story. And people need a clear, specific, stepwise process for change and an informed guide to help them, an accountability partner. And what you're expert at is nothing to do with anything healthcare or wellness. You're an expert at change. Your specialty is choice architecture, to look at a client's choice this moment. So the mission of wellness coaching is to help people establish a better wellness story, to write an evolving change and transformation story for their benefit. Now, in addition to individuals interested in health and longevity and wellness, who needs wellness coaching? Well, an answer is any business that's interested in achieving some fairly reasonable goals, reducing medical claims, lowering stress, reducing absenteeism, improving morale, improving retention rates, generate overall savings to the organization. So what's the scope of wellness coaching? So in addition to individual and group coaching, here are just some examples of a portal of entry, the gatekeepers for wellness coaching. Human resource heads and groups, employee assistance programs, healthcare insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, small business owners, especially organizations that are self-insured. Natural affiliates of a wellness coach may include fitness trainers, health clubs, nutritionists, holistic care providers, any health care provider, consortiums of wellness practitioners. So let's move to the application now. why is it that change is so difficult? In studies of coronary bypass patients, when their lives are at risk after having massive cardiac events, unless they adapt healthier lifestyles, how many do you think change their habits when they're given education after the coronary bypass, after the serious life-threatening cardiac event? How many change? 1 in 9. Information is not enough. It took Ignaz Semmelweis more than 20 years to persuade doctors that washing their hands could save the lives of mothers giving birth. He had the data, the proof, but that wasn't enough to change minds. He actually died before people believed and changed. Changing behavior is difficult. So what is it that keeps people from doing what they need to do for themselves that makes it so difficult to change even when their life depends on it? Some of the resistance is staying in a comfort zone of the predictable and the familiar. We're hardwired to repeat. Another component of resistance is our brains actually resist change and are programmed to operate on the default mode of repetition. So keep this question in mind. Why is change so difficult? We're going to return to it and strategize about it. Now, you have to own your wellness story. That's the difference with the people who go to a physician, get expert advice, and don't feel it's not their story. It's the physician's story. People don't want to change. If you see a light on the dashboard that says service engine out, well, you can ignore it. You can disconnect it. And another term is simply denial. But once you know something, you can never really not know it again. Denial is a form of engagement, even though invisible above ground. People are afraid to go to the doctor, but they aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial will be confronted. Making a physical symptom go away does the same thing. The symptom is the signal. It's a story in itself, a story that needs and begs to be listened to and understood. Your body will simply find another way to bring you more information. If you listen to whispers, no one has to shout, including your body. And just because you're not sick doesn't mean you're healthy. So think about wellness, in one sense, as a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of the life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. That's what I mean by charts architecture. Whatever you think, feel, and experience, you create this moment. And whatever you experience, you either create or you agree to. Warren Buffett used the analogy of driving a car. He said, if you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew from the beginning you were going to have one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for it, probably change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing that would be the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Everything counts. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you read The Wellness System of Energy in the preface of the workbook, beginning on page little x little ii of 12 in the introduction. It introduces some later discussion on the impact of change on mind and brain. And later, if you have just a couple of minutes, look in the addendum of the workbook on page 6 to see how two little French fries can weigh 40 pounds. Now, back to more serious things. From the teachings of the Tao, the source of spiritual energy is physical, rooted in the basic chemistry of the body. Self-cultivation refines this energy for spiritual alignment. Enlightenment is a psychophysiological achievement, a state of being rather than intellectual understanding. Spirituality is simply one expression of energy. So let's look now at developing a new wellness story. We are in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. This has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Of 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination or disregard. Three areas that people know exactly what to do and don't do it. Working out, food, and money. More than anything else, people put off exercise, eating a planned healthy diet, and funding their retirement plan. If you treated a task such as exercise with the same mindset as work, with work, you don't have to get up each day and debate about whether you will or won't work out, whether you'll take a couple of days off, or bargain with yourself and say, well, I'm just going to start really do it next Tuesday. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate it, you don't consider yourself virtuous if you decide to do it. In school, later in work, you show up. Same thing, same mindset that you can apply to working out each day. For example, I grew up on a farm and ranch. Every morning before school, beginning age 7, I fed the cattle. Same thing every evening. It was a given. No questions asked. Morning, evening, 7 days a week, cattle had to eat. And my dad, thankfully, helped me make it my story. It stopped being work when some of them were my cattle. But think about exercise as a similar kind of mindset, the default story. It needs a plan and a commitment, just like your business. That's also why people need coaches. Biologically, your body only knows two things, growth or decay. Dr. Henry Lodge Jr., in his book Younger Next Year and a companion book, Younger Next Year for Women, says this and found this. He's devoted 35 years of his medical practice to wellness research. 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body, and each bathe cells in either repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. Even recent research at the University of Vermont showed that moderate physical activity improves mood up to 12 hours after activity. So we're going to look at the process of change in an informed and a systematic way. And first, I want to provide some context and stimulus for you to actively work on the exercises and quizzes, at least some of them, in the workbook for each of the 7 steps that we're going to be doing. The composite, as I mentioned, is a template, a roadmap, the seven steps to guide and apply a wellness story. So first look at the power of story. This is something we do and engage on a regular basis with each client. So first, to look at that for you, write this question down so you can come back to it when you can maybe schedule an appointment with yourself, even for a brief time, to answer these two questions. What is my story? When you do this and return to it, think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Bullet your major storylines, not your bio, your title, your role, your plot. Then write this question. What is my wellness story? And again, consider making an appointment with yourself to brainstorm these two questions. So here are some premises that our work together will be based on in developing a wellness story. One, and this is all in your outline, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the outline of life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories inform what we look for and how we attribute meaning to what we experience. Two, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. Our brains want and need stories to make sense of things. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, you know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Defense lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. We personify the economy or the stock market as if it were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer a relationship and assign causality. Or we can even ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. My ulcer acted up. My weight gets in the way. My doubt paralyzed me. Three, we each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and what we process and how we attribute meaning. The brain needs a story. It will infer one, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information and experience into a system that makes sense. We then create life narratives according to that plot, since mind and brain are both programmed to process by the default mode and to ignore facts that contradict assumptions. We'll return to that, and I'll give you some examples, depending on our time, for coaching application. Four, a life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions tell us what to look for and how to perceive and process experiences. And first, we have to believe in order to see, or it will not register, or we'll just ignore it. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to us. Here's an example. Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, and most recently Broadway hit Wicked, if you guys have watched the Academy Awards last night for the film, said this, I didn't even realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent. Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. After his 23rd book, he became conscious of that fact to say, I can't seem to start a novel until the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, the mother was still there. What's the problem? There's nothing to write about. My conjecture, he probably got a coach after his 23rd book. Five, we believe and remember only that which fits our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experiences in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. Someone abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in current and future relationships, even though circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by our narrative plot. Six, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we always become right because we write the story. Here's an example. This is out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. A year later, the two anthropologists emerged to compare notes and expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a unity and comfort, amazing amount of information with the interaction. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony and remained careful and vigilant, always kind of right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved that harmony. The anthropologists and their teams could not understand these discrepant results and puzzled until for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun, just in case. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a commitment, and he knew from the beginning he would either make it or not on his own. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they then experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. Seven. A story can define possibility. Here's an example. You guys know this. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. It was deemed physiologically impossible. And if someone did make it under 4 minutes, which they could anyhow, they wouldn't live. But Dr. Roger Bannister broke the four-minute mile in 1954. Within the following 12 months, over a dozen other runners broke the four-minute mile as well. Within 12 months, the obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. Today, this is commonplace. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. Actually, when Bannister crossed the finish line, he collapsed and actually passed out. He was revived with smelling salts. His first question was, am I alive? He believed what he assumed and was told. Eight, a story can define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient's prescribed an inert pill plus some expectations, in other words, a story. In the vast majority of cases, the story becomes the reality. By anticipating an experience, we can create it. The story generates a truth so powerful it can even reverse the pharmacological effects of a real medicine. The placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that becomes a truth. A fairly recent MIT study even showed that a more expensive placebo worked significantly better than a much cheaper placebo. Same placebo, different stories. And this is not about being gullible or suggestible. When a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. Medical research suggests that up to 70% of successful non-surgical treatments are the results of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. 9. A story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates is then perceived to act on its creator. So here are some ways that we can see ourselves as the victim of the story that we create rather than the author. My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creation. Another example of the power of story is a woman I know who recalled an incident from her adolescence. A practicing attorney was reflecting on her adolescence. She attended an all-girls boarding school. She said, at one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked and everybody got drunk. 10. Your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. Everyone is always making self-statements, so don't take it personally. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves and what they think or feel or want. They want to make themselves feel better, what they do or don't want to own, what they disavow or project. And if any of you watch the political news, here's a simple example of that. Accusations are confessions. I will not comment any further on that. 11. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation that when you change the way you look at things you look at change, came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. Think about how that principle applied in the energy fields of the two anthropologists who had very different assumptions and very different results. 12. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. I want to say that again, and I want you to listen to it as a professional coach and working with a client. This is why I only work with clients in mentor coaching in whom I believe, because I know they will show us both why. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. Now, that's not enough alone. You need a strategy in a system, which is exactly what we're going to be talking about. And this comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known this for centuries. So let's return now to the question about the difficulty of change. Why do we resist change? Even changing a story that works, even when you know exactly what to do and don't do it, or have a client that knows and doesn't do it. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will they repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result? even when it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued career or disappointing relationship. Nassim Taleb asks in The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. Here's a two-part answer to that specific question. Why do we resist change? Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone, our default mode. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or actually uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's predictable. It's the default model. We repeat because we know exactly how it's going to turn out, and that can create the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. Think about this as you work with a client. Every step in a new or different direction is going to register in some way as discomfort because it's unprecedented. They haven't quite done that like that before. So it's important that you empathically appreciate that, maybe even help them reframe it to look at it as a signpost that they're proceeding. The discomfort is validation of being in new territory. They may misread it as, well, my intuition is telling me this isn't right, or my gut's telling me I'm doing the wrong thing. That's a misread because their experience is the error detection mechanism in their brain, which we'll come back to, and the default mode of operating that they're abandoning and breaking the script to take a step into the new, the different, the unknown, is simply registering as some discomfort. This needs to be understood by us and to help our clients understand and even frame it in a way as progress. We'll come back to that. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, an internal map that's synonymous with identity. We always tend to return to our default mode. And a new story, even breaking the script for a moment, generates uncertainty and trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. So do just a brief exercise. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers and grasp firmly to interlock your fingers. Now, that's a usual thing you do, right? Notice now which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same firm grip, but change so that your other thumb is on top. How's that feel? A little bit goofy, a little bit awkward. Now, move your thumbs back to the original place. Ah, a relief. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as major transition, really out of a comfort zone. Now, we'll talk later about comfort zones and how to program change. And here's the principle. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. That's how our minds and brains work. Now, a comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. So think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. The temperature increases or decreases, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point. It only takes a degree or two. Set point is the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. Think about you even have a comfort zone with your weight. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable, but it's predictable and automatic, and we know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone, the repetition, and the certainty can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program, sitting at the same place at the table every night, ordering the same. You go over the menu, but you end up ordering the same thing at your favorite restaurant. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. And remember, we are choice architects. We don't go into the past. We don't ask why questions. We're looking at the moment of choice, what we think and feel and experience each moment, and helping the client to do that. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. Here's a story that I think illustrates this. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that every person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its really circuitous route. He repeated that with even more diabolical turns. Same thing. Not a single person created a new path. No one started a new, more direct route. No matter how many turns and twists, each person followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. Discomfort and uncertainty began any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. It signals to warn us that this is a departure. We'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So, listen for the power of stories. Your brain can rewire. New experiences practiced consistently form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can alter gene expression. So, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains as well. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. This is also from the Black Swan. Ideas come and go, stories stay. Now, let's look at active choice. I think this is a study specifically for coaches. It wasn't designed that way. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact of this study with a large number of volunteers. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, he had the subjects choose a different option from poles of contrasting behavior. They were given choices like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would pick one of the two and behave that way the entire day. So an introverted person, for example, if they chose to act as an extrovert, would do that for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, he had the volunteers stretch to behave in a way outside their usual practice. He had them twice a week read something they would have never read before, and to eat something twice a week they would never have imagined eating before. So, after 4 months of doing this, 5 days a week, what do you think was the biggest change in this group? The finding, I think the remarkable finding, is the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off, and through a year, which is the length of the follow-up, they continued to lose weight. Now, the researchers were baffled. This was not a diet, but a study focusing on change and its impact. The rationale. Requiring people to change routine behavior, to break their usual script, made them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. Think about your last meal. You sit down to eat. You may pay attention to what you're eating, first two or three bites, but then you're thinking about something else, having a conversation with somebody. What these people did was to think about each choice. Most of them recognized in reflection that they considered everything they did as a choice. They even considered each bite as a choice, not just unconscious eating. And they would ask themselves, is this bite in my best interest? Instead of choosing habitually a default mode. So in coaching, this is story busting, breaking the script. The participants exercised choice in this study. It was a conscious decision that they could then extend and use that process to other things, eating what not to eat as well as other choices. As coaches, again, we're choice architects, to help a client be aware that a choice right now for this moment is the story that they're writing. It's not there until the client creates it. Once becoming actively aware of making choices, you can then decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. Is this bite in your best interest? So, a kind of summary and overview, some principles of facilitating change for us as coaches. And all of these 10 are in your outline. And I just want to discuss it each a bit more. So this is principles that focus on facilitating change. It's a preface to writing a new wellness story. First principle. Each person's life story and wellness story is created. In adulthood, you create whatever you think, feel, and experience each moment. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on it, even though it may seem to be just the way things are, because things are hardwired. The default mode needs to be activated, though, and acquiesced and agreed to and created each moment, or something else, maybe breaking the script. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Three, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. We commit to what we co-create. This is a principle of having the client's story in focus, with the client as point of reference in developing that story. Not telling the client what to do, not giving suggestions, advice, or usurping that point of reference and making it our story, or running in a play, or camouflaging advice in the form of a multiple choice, or a have you thought about whatever. Three, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. This establishes the beginning of effectiveness and mastery. The antithesis, somebody tells you what to do. When we have a moment of insight, an aha experience, three different parts of our brain light up, and we're vaulted instantly into a state that is able to synthesize and integrate and be creative more than the instant before. Here's reviewing that same brain, same fMRI scan, when there's information, facts, data, no part of the brain lights up. Nothing happens. Four, change is constant and inevitable. It's resistance to change that generates most problems. We're most successful when we learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. This is the growth mindset that informs our coaching story. 5, small changes can lead to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue in order to specify progress. For example, you feel overwhelmed with the amount of tasks? Pick one. Clarify one issue that you can start now. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a process and ultimately model of mastery. 6, problems, causes, solutions are not always related or even interconnected. This is why we don't begin a coaching session by asking about what's the biggest problem you have today. Correlation is not the same as causality. To resolve a problem, even emotionally, to come to the end of a task does not create a blueprint for success. This is one of the reasons that I did a change and transformation from practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis, clinical professor, to move to coaching, because we operate in a very different model. And coming to the end of the past does not create a blueprint for success or a new story. That's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. They come to the end of the past, but there's not a new story to suddenly take over. Strategic plans and specific goals are necessary. If something is a totally new experience, you may need a guide. Even for something like creating a healthier diet or exercise that the client develops. 7, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. This, I believe, even more scientifically put, is the essence of coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. 8, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will actually enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. And the end should be in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll, I think, said it very clearly. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" asked the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." 9, you need the correct paradigm. A paradigm, also a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world, how we frame something. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning, and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines, states of mind. We're often not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. And a dilemma means having two or more mental maps that are in conflict. We can come back to that. If you'd like to discuss that. An example here is we need to be afraid of the right thing. Smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. People may fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. And finally, number 10, decide what you want. Believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception. A belief is the mind's command to the brain, the software that drives behavior. And we know now that beliefs can turn genes on and off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are determined by what we allow ourselves to see. We're in discussion mode now. If you have any thoughts or questions or clarifications, and if you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in any comments or thoughts that you have that might be helpful for us to discuss just briefly. We have 2 or 3 minutes. Anyone want to add or ask or clarify anything? Would anyone like to share, just in a single sentence, what's the most important thing you're taking away from this first seminar? Take a chance. You don't even have to say your name, but you're welcome to. What's the most important thing you're taking away?
That we see what we believe because we write the story. That was major.
Thank you. Okay, great. You got it. I agree with you. Who else?
I have something to add.
Okay.
What I took away from this seminar today the most is do more of what is working and less of what is not.
A basic tenet of coaching, yes. Thank you, yeah. Okay, thank you. What else? Who else? Any other thoughts or takeaways?
Focus on the system, not the outcome.
Could you get a little closer to the microphone or off a headset or speakerphone and talk more directly? I want to be sure we hear everything.
Sure. Focus on the system, not the outcome.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Absolutely. Who else? Any other additions? We've got less than a minute, but I'd like to hear anyone else. Well, the recording will be posted at the place you look to get the outline and download the outline and workbook. It will be posted tomorrow. If you have any questions or additions or clarifications, or for those of you who weren't able to attend and listening to the recording, if you have any questions, fire an email. And if you still think about those two questions I asked in the email, send a response. They will help me know what to wrap into our discussion, what you're interested in, and what would be of most help to you and the best way to make even a seminar collaborative and useful to you. So I want to optimize that possibility. Thank you all very much for attending, for your energy, and for the number of you who have already sent in responses to the question. Look forward to picking you up right here next time. So take good care of yourselves. Feel free to fire off an email to me. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.